Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jerry Lubinow, editor of the California Journal of Politics and Policy at the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley, and I will be your moderator for tonight's program. I'm very pleased to introduce tonight's speaker. Sam Popkin is professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, and author of the new book, The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. Professor Popkin has had an illustrious career in presidential politics, serving as a polling and strategy consultant for the Clinton campaign, advising the CBS News election unit on survey design and analysis, and most recently acting as an advisor to the Gore campaign. He has served as a consultant to political parties in Canada and Europe, as well as to the U.S. Departments of State and Defense. In addition to his new book, Professor Popkin is the author of The Reasoning Voter, Communication and Persuasion in Presidential Campaigns, co-author of Issues and Strategies, The Computer Simulation of Presidential Campaigns, and co-editor of Chief of Staff, 25 Years of Managing the Presidency. Please welcome Professor Sam Popkin.
It's gone.
It's good.
Well, here, you can have mine. I'm not allowed to use the gavel. I'm under strict orders to cut my verbosity down to 20 minutes so that there's a lot of room for questions. So I'm going to emphasize one particular part of the book that I believe is most relevant in the months ahead as the campaign takes final shape and form. And that is that there is a fundamental difference between the weapons and strategies of a challenger and an incumbent. People make the mistake when somebody is president of saying, can they do it again like they did it last time? Never can it be the same. I want to emphasize the difference between what makes a good challenger, what makes a good incumbent, and how they use the tools, the options, the resources available to them in the campaign. I'm not going to make predictions. You all know who I want to win. But I'm here to help you understand better the patterns that unfold over and over in campaigns, not my statistical side of predicting how much is the economy going to help or hurt or this vote, but what are the ways that as a candidate in an organization you lay it out. Now, let me start with the challenger. I title the chapter on challengers in my book, The Pattern of Challengers, The Search for an Experienced Virgin, because what people want in a challenger from the out party are two contradictory things. You want somebody who's pure, who never compromises, who embodies your ideals as their ideals, and yet is experienced enough to handle the mud, the dirt, and the swamp in Washington and clean it up without any problems, like magic. And that the only person who ever came close to that was Yoda. You know, and he's from out of the solar system. He's from a timid swamp of a planet like Washington. You know, is skilled in combat and a moral vision. And the basis of what you're doing as a challenger is your vision of where you want to take the country. What is it you're going to do, and where are you going to take the country? And it's your vision that people look at, not specific details of your plans. But the question is, when you're doing that, it's like a marriage proposal. It's like what Stendhal talks about love. You're asking people to take a leap of faith. Since you believe in me, believing is seeing. When you believe in the challenger, Obama, Clinton, Reagan, Carter, something about them inspires you to know the government will embody this essence when they are there. The government will be like them. They will be the government. And when you ask them to do that leap of faith, whether you will do it depends on if they have a moral firewall to protect them, to reassure you that they mean it, that they're as pure as Yoda, or that they clearly have a record. And there's two things that they build the credibility of their promise on: their character or their past performance. One of the two is the evidence that they mean what they say, that they're not just making you cheap promises, that it's Friday night and if you spend the night with me, I'll love you forever. Or really, this car will never rust. You know, you have to have the character. Governor Romney had a problem in the primaries that Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Senator Obama did not have in the primaries. George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, Senator Obama had their challenges from the center. They didn't have to move that far to the left or right to get through the primary. I mean, we have this terrible, well, difficult. It's not terrible. It's important. We have this very tricky two-step you have to make to get to the White House. First, you have to get to 30 or 35 or 40% of the country to get through the primary. And you have to get through the primary without getting closer to 40 and farther from 50 at the same time. The great Paul Tully used that phrase to describe what happened to President Bush in 1992 when the Houston Republican Convention turned into a religious revival. He said, the closer Bush gets to 40%, the farther Bush gets from 50%. And this is tricky. It was easier for Obama, Clinton, and George W. Bush because there wasn't a horrifying, terrible need to move. Governor Romney walked into a minefield. He was the only Republican candidate with a reasonable chance of getting to 50 in the fall and without having a Pyrrhic victory in the primary. But everybody else was willing to have a Pyrrhic victory because there was no other way for them to get the nomination and then pray for rain and something magical to happen later. You know, sometimes you have to throw the chances. And look at what happened to the Massachusetts moderate, the respectable, almost Rockefellerian Republican on the way. Contraception wasn't his idea to bring up. You know, abortion you can sort of finesse a little and get away with, but when you start attacking contraception, you're in trouble. He was hit hard on that. Then, of course, the big one. Imagine this was still 2009 when Governor Romney of Massachusetts wrote a USA Today op-ed that said, if President Obama drops the public option in the health care plan, he'll have the perfect plan, just like I gave Massachusetts. Oops. There goes the Tea Party. So now you have to repudiate your health care plan. And to get through the primaries and contrast yourself with Rick Perry and the others, you get even tougher on immigration. So we've got all this going against him. He wants the program to be, he wants his, all through the primaries, he had two very smart lines, very well done. Obama's not working, and I've had 25 years of business experience. I know how to bring about jobs. But he hasn't explained yet a lot of what he learned that he would be different with. It's not enough. You read now everywhere, Mark McKinnon, Peggy Noonan, all the Republicans saying, what's after the applause line? What is it you're doing instead? When you're president, it's not enough to say you haven't done well, so I should be obviously there. You have to explain what you're going to do different, and it's particularly the case because we have a divided government, which I'll come back to in a moment. Now, this was a big weekend for the left to worry about the right and the right to rattle their cages. While I'm here in San Diego, the Koch brothers and all of the other people who are willing to pay $100,000 and up to come to a meeting and consider giving $10 million or more to the Super PAC fund gathered, I don't know where. I don't know if anybody got a secret taping this year. But they're there to go after the president. It's overrated. I can say that not as a blustering spokesman for the president, but as a historical analysis analyst. The robber barons, the press barons, the money people want Obama out. And they're going after his character, and they're attacking him on his character. Let me just point out that before we had super PACs, the equivalent of the super PAC was the newspaper editorials. In 1936, depending on which historian I read, Franklin D. Roosevelt got either 20% or 35% of the newspaper support. Roosevelt never once had the powerful media machine on his side in his election, in his re-election campaigns. Number two, all of these groups have their own agendas, and they're out for themselves not as much as they are out for Romney. And number three, just as important, you can't create a we without creating a they, and the they notices. When people make the far right happy by going after the president, did you know he's African American? Did you know he has black children born in wedlock? You know, all these attacks, you know, they make a lot of people very happy. And they make it very clear to a lot of other people just what's going on. And most important of all, the fundamental difference between how you judge an incumbent and how you judge a challenger is you judge the incumbent on deeds, not character. It's a consistent pattern in the actual election data going back 60 years, that you look at them differently. Now, if Romney wants you to take a leap of faith, the whole Obama campaign is you better look before you leap. And it's not about a referendum on him. It's a choice between two futures. And it's really, do you want Paul Ryan as in the White House or not, is what it's going to boil down to, I predict. Now, his campaign has been a little sloppy, even for an incumbent. Think of it like a challenger is a speedboat, and they're supposed to be able to move very quickly, but they make very small waves. The incumbent is a battleship. It takes forever to turn the damn thing, but when you do, it can make a very big wave and carry a lot of firepower. And at the State of the Union, Obama started to cure himself of what a psychoanalyst in Washington called obsessive bipartisan disorder and started to realize, and I show this in the book, the heart of every successful incumbent when their things aren't great, which is almost always, is the way they play the divided government. And the memos written for Truman in 46 when he got shellacked in the midterms and in 48 are still the roadmap that fits exactly what Clinton did, what Reagan did. It's quite extraordinary. In the State of the Union, instead of suggesting specific legislation, the president turned to Congress and said things like, it's time for Congress to make sure no foreign country has an advantage in manufacturing. Send me a bill that bans insider trading and I'll sign it tomorrow. Congress should do something about student interest rates. Not saying here's a bill that you can eviscerate, humiliate, enervate. Just where is your bill? Where's the legislation? And that's a big part of it, is the way you call on people. A second part that he played, you're seeing it played brilliantly in the last week, is when a party is divided on an issue, they try and suppress it and keep it out of legislation. The Republicans have two they've always tried to suppress: stem cells and immigration. They can't decide what to do. They know there's a suicide position in the short run, and they know there's a suicide position in the long run, the way black crime and welfare and stuff used to be before the Democrats figured out a way to talk about it for whites and blacks together. When he suggested the presidential directive, not even an executive order, on immigration, you notice instead of reiterating what was necessary to get through the primaries, Senator Rubio and Governor Romney both said, he should have let Congress do it. He should have let Congress do it. Why did he do it? And then Dan Quayle's son is chirping in, Congressman Quayle, saying, it's unconstitutional. It isn't unconstitutional. It's a perfect move. And if they want to take it to the Supreme Court, I'll bet you anything it stands. And all they have to do is pass a law outlawing what he did. Bill Clinton wanted an executive order for gays in the military, and the Senate said to him, yes, you can issue the order, and we'll overturn it in 48 hours. Because that, in 1992, as opposed to 2012, there wasn't anything approaching an understanding nationally or a consensus nationally of where we should be as a country. But now you've got the problem for Governor Romney, and I predict you'll see something on stem cells as well. And the same thing happened, you'll notice, on gay marriage. When the president decided, and forget about the Biden thing, the important thing was it was obvious that the president had to say something before the convention if he didn't want riots. He had to decide before North Carolina, like it or not, what he was going to say about gay marriage. You couldn't leave this on the table with 1,000 people yelling in the delegate hall, open your, do something brave. So he made the point. You notice nobody in the Republican Party has called for a constitutional ban outside of a few small parishes. Nobody has said this is, you know, everybody knows that it's going to happen, like it or not. It's a part of American life because it's the fastest change socially we've ever seen, the way attitudes have come around piece by piece. The third thing of what you've got as president, besides your vetoes and your calls on the other party, you know, you realize when you're challenger, you promise the moon to everybody. By definition, no president has ever done more than they promised they would do. And that means the challenger always is able to honestly say, you promised a full glass and the glass is half full. And the president says, well, if it weren't for me, the glass would be empty. Or I've kept it half full, or it's starting to fill. And they realize that they're not the government. They're the commander-in-chief with 17 votes in the Senate. And I say 17 votes in the Senate because if the president wants to sign a bill, 50 votes, senators can give it to him. If the president wants to veto a bill, it takes 67. When you have a divided government, you really have power. Your left or your right, whichever party you're in, can't ever get anything in front of you that you have to worry about. And the other side can make hell that you can protect the country from. And you notice on interest rates and student loans, the president is playing that role legitimately, just the way President Reagan did it. All the presidents have this ability to stop excesses of one party. I mean, Bill Clinton was in real trouble in 96 until the Republicans went so far overboard with Gingrich and the freshman congressman that the senators decided they had to give Clinton an acceptable welfare reform bill that he could sign to save themselves. And the day they quit giving him bills that he would veto and gave him a bill he would sign, the Dole strategist, Tony Fabrizio, said that was the day they aimed the torpedoes at our ship, and after the holes were in the ship, they poured water in the holes. That was what sunk Dole, they thought. That was his last hope. And the third piece of it, he's the commander-in-chief. Now, compare his two trips to Afghanistan. 2008, McCain says, wimpy, wussy Obama, you've never even been to the battle zone. So Barack Obama, Senator Barack Obama, goes to Afghanistan, shoots a three-pointer, and signs autographs. This time, President Obama goes to Afghanistan, celebrates shooting bin Laden, and signs a treaty. It's a big difference. You know, it's not quite Nixon goes to China. It's not the end. It's not something quite cataclysmic. But imagine what happens in a debate. I played Reagan in the practice debate, so I think about the debate lines and because I learned so much from that extraordinary experience. Imagine when somebody, when Romney tries to say, you're a wuss, you're a wimp, you're a sissy boy, you don't know about muscle and tough America. You say, well, you know, Al-Qaeda might not agree. Or, mate, you're just droning on. You know? there's so many things you can say that way. Now, my 20 minutes are with, I'm probably only a minute or two over, so I'm near the end. There are traps ahead. Every campaign is about uncertainty. I started the book thinking it's about having a great strategy. Then I realized the military saying is really powerful. Planning is everything. The plan is nothing. Because the plan only lasts till the day the war starts. There's all the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns, to quote Secretary Rumsfeld. This is one of the few times where everybody knows that something really strange, unpredictable, and unplannable entirely is going to happen. When the Supremes finally sing this week, it's going to be it's going to be cacophony in both parties, and somebody's going to have to figure out in the rubble what's going on. I mean, it's going to be an extraordinarily complicated event for both parties. At the same time, there are two really big challenges ahead for Governor Romney. And of course, President Obama's got the problems of the economy. If the unemployment were 6%, we'd be celebrating his great 4 years. Or moaning his 4 years, depending on your side. This is San Francisco, mostly celebration. You've got real problems at your convention. Number one, I know enough about candidates to know anybody who wins as many states as Senator Santorum and who then pulls out the day before Pennsylvania so he won't lose in his home state and lose his street cred, and who gives his dying 3-year-old daughter a lifetime membership in the NRA, thinks he can be the candidate in 2016 if Governor Romney loses. So he's going to do everything he can to help Romney, in spirit, to look like he's doing everything he can, and, quotes, helping him by keeping his issues alive for the good of the party and the country. So you've got, and there's no easy way, I mean, of all this $400 million they're raising in San Diego, if they said to Santorum, we'll give you $25 million to take over a foundation and take a 2-year fact-finding trip first, they'd be better off. But, of course, when you've got that bug, it doesn't work. And the other one is, who's your vice president going to be? You know, the auditions are going on now. It's a very tricky job to make the conservatives happy enough and do something that will help you to get to the middle later. I'm willing to bet a lot that it'll never be Senator Rubio, and not because of immigration, but because I realized for a few years his family were Mormons. Now, as a Jew, I didn't know exactly the strange status Mormons hold for many Christians. I thought they were just like Baptists, Methodists, Wesleyans. I didn't know, because we have so many really, really good graduate students who have done missionary work and want to study comparative politics, I didn't realize how tricky this was. I can't imagine how many conspiracy theories there would be if you had 1 1/4 Mormons on the ticket or one. This is not something that makes me feel prouder of America, although it might not be so bad this time in some deep way. But it's clearly a problem to find somebody who keeps the right from rebelling against him. And I'm hoping as a Democrat now that Vice President Biden will say something like, well, why don't they just put Paul Ryan on the ticket and make it official? Why have to make him go back and forth, you know, in Washington? Just put him in the White House so he can run the show on the spot easily for Mitt. Okay, my time is up, and there's a lot of questions, so I better stop right now. I hope when you look at the book, you'll see how the patterns emerge. I wrote this not to give you a formula to win an election, but for you to understand the rhythms and so you could better see how the candidate was doing as they plan ahead.
Our thanks to Professor Sam Popkin, Professor of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego, and author of The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. I'm Jerry Lubinow, editor of the California Journal of Politics and Policy at the Institute of Governmental Studies at Berkeley, and I'm your moderator for tonight's program. Professor Popkin, we have a number of questions, so let's get right to them.
Yes, sir.
Not surprisingly, a number of them have to do with money. Let's start with the one that deals with Citizens United. What is the impact of the new Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, on winning elections? Let me add before you go, there's a more generic one. Is it possible to stop the incredible high amounts of money involved in politics, in presidential politics? Maybe you can link the two.
Well, the only way to stop the amount of money is to stop the Buckley ruling in the Supreme Court that said an individual can spend as much of their own money as they want. Because if you want people who don't have $200 million of their own money to run for office, somebody's going to have to put up money, and it's not going to get cheaper. I don't mind the amounts of money, and I don't take big money as a consultant. I worked in Vietnam, and my rule is you don't change governments for money after that mess. You know, so I'm not a profiteer on this, but I think most of the money is needed. The evil thing, to my mind, for America about Citizens United was it puts the money outside the system where you get this cacophony of people not coordinated with the candidate or the party that make it easier for people to hold up or blackmail candidates in one party or the other. And I wish, if there, anything, the money was funneled together. The one thing this year I can say is this is the year Ed Rollins criticized Fox News for making it easy for fringe radical candidates to raise a few million dollars with outrageous statements. You know, this is the part of the year that makes it harder. And the same thing is going on. The real question on super PACs and Mitt Romney is, can he break even on them? Look at what the damage they did to him by opening up all the attacks on Bain Capital and what did you really do there? Look at the damage they did when Foster Fries, who's now giving money to him, gave millions to Senator Santorum. Is Sheldon Adelson going to get back? Can he rewind the tape of the $10 million spent attacking Bain Capital now that Romney's his favorite candidate?
One final question on finances while we're on it. We have one questioner who seems skeptical of the importance placed on money and ask if there really have been elections where whoever spent the most won.
I'm not sure if whoever spent the most. Well, probably, yeah, well, Barack Obama, Senator Obama spent more because nobody wanted to give to a dying party. I don't think there's, but I don't know what the pattern is on that. So I'm afraid I have to finesse it.
Mm-hmm. Could Romney have won the nomination if he didn't change his position on health care, abortion, taxes, and most other things?
Probably not. And that's what really got me to understand a lot of this is what happened to Governor Dewey of New York in 1948, who was really, to my surprise and amazement, one of the more impressive, dynamic, and articulate people ever to run for president, who looked like a stiff by the time it was over, who looked stiffer than Governor Dukakis in 88 because there was nothing left he could say once the party kept sabotaging all of his policies so they could get the nomination. I mean, Senator Taft did to Dewey everything he could to make it impossible for him to run on his very admirable program so that he could run in 52.
We've had a couple of questions on what happens to Obama's campaign if Obamacare is overturned. But while you're at that, why don't you talk as much as well about the impact of the immigration decision that came down today?
The immigration decision today is frosting on the Obama immigration cake. The big surprise on the immigration of the last 2 weeks, even a bigger surprise than how very well received was the gay marriage statements of the president, where not many people care enough to worry about arguing with the president, even if you're 51-49 in some place, not ready for marriage as opposed to union, the president tilted it very strongly. And on immigration, when the court ruled today that part of the Arizona law can stand, that pretty much unless the Republicans repudiate that, and Governor Romney can't because he said that's the model we should be following, and the big plus on all this, the surprise, was how most of middle America agrees with what the president did. Despite the bad economy and a lot of anti-immigrant attitudes, the idea that if you're hardworking and educated, you should just be sort of thrown out is not supportable everywhere.
We have a couple of questions relating to the Supreme Court, one sort of looking back and one looking forward. In light of the Florida Supreme Court decision in Bush v. Gore, why did the Supreme Court intervene and act?
I can't answer that. I'm sorry. I don't know how to answer.
Was it reasonable for them to do so?
I don't think anything they do is reasonable, but that's a political statement. I'm not a scholarly statement. I was thinking today about how once upon a time everybody dreamed about a child growing up, and if, God forbid, they're going to be a lawyer, they could be on the Supreme Court. And I wondered if people feel that way today with the kind of dispute and the change in the feeling. And I feel so sad about the idea. Once upon a time, we looked up to them. And I don't have that same feeling of the incivility. And that's all I can say. Mm-hmm. It's personal.
Well, the next question, which is looking forward, sort of plays off that. How do you think the weighted Supreme Court decisions being made in recent weeks will influence the presidential campaign? There's actually been some talk of Obama's advisors about running against the Supreme Court.
I don't think you have to run against the Supreme Court. I think you will be running against the Supreme Court if they throw parts down. 20 years ago, we used to talk about the Supreme Court and the Clinton campaign, and, oh, we got to make something about the court. We got to, remind people abortion rights was the big issue, civil rights. And George Stephanopoulos very accurately used to say, look, it's a billiard shot. It's too complicated at the time. If enough justices die and somebody bad is appointed, then it'll happen. So it's a concatenation. Now I think the court is so vivid that it's a mass issue the way it never was 16 or 20 years ago. So I think now he doesn't even have to talk about it. He just has to say, when I pick judges, I will be looking for people who understand. That's all you have to say.
Mm-hmm. The next question has to do with the circumstances that surround the defeat of incumbent presidents in recent years. Bush, 41, Carter, Ford, do those same apply this year? Is it the economy stupid? What were the key factors?
Well, the clever thing about James Carville's remark, the economy stupid, was it really pushed a lot of reporters away from talking about social issues and liberal issues. The economy is several issues at the minimum. Unemployment, inflation, interest rates, the future. The whole thing that started with the teabags of 89 and 90 that moved into Ross Perot that you see in the Tea Party is a white middle-class movement worried about holding on. Just like everybody on coastal California says, not in my backyard, about refineries and nuclear power plants. Let them build them in Fresno or, God forbid, build them in Alaska or whatever. Don't put any pipelines near me. There's millions of mid-life, 50-year-old Americans who are saying, I know you got to change entitlements, but I deserve my Medicare and my pensions, and I deserve my Social Security, so don't do anything about it till after I'm gone. So not in my lifetime is a kind of a movement. And there are these fights you see in the Republican Party between reasonable taxes to do something about the worthy entitlements, which we can all fight about what entitlements are worthy, and the people who say there shouldn't be any government, there shouldn't be an EPA, there shouldn't be a Defense Department, It's going to be there's a civil war going on over what the government should be left with.
Well, every election year there's this sort of tap dance that goes on around the vice presidency, and someone is asking why everyone seems to be turning down Romney's vice presidency.
Why do you think? Well, first of all, I think several of the people who, quotes, are needed by their family don't like the smell of the Civil War and the party and the taint they would be left with. You know, it's a very unusual thing to think I'm better off hiding this year than running. You know, Jeb Bush has got one shot. Jeb Bush, if he wanted to be the vice president, would be a very helpful one. But he's clearly calculated, and he's come out, in fact, very strong attacking Grover Norquist and the tax pledge demands. He really laid the shots down for the future when he said things like what Governor Huntsman of Utah said when he said, I don't outsource my values to people outside my constituency. I don't sign pledges. I make promises to my constituents. And that was a shot against the anti-tax. And he was the one who said, Ronald Reagan, as well as my father, wouldn't be at home in the party today. And that, I suspect, might be the beginning of a Republican equivalent of the Democratic Leadership Council. You know, if I'm going to take a minute, I want to say something in praise of Walter Mondale. He lost as badly as you can lose in 1984, and he probably saved the Democratic Party by being such an honorable, solid, sound, big loser. And I'm not being sarcastic. I remember at the 92 convention bumping into Peter Hart, who was Mondale's pollster, and saying, you know, Peter, if Mondale had been a bad candidate, everybody would have said it's the messenger, not the message. Nobody said that message will sell if we only had a better voice or a better candidate. Everybody said, we got a problem. We can't be as strongly pro old style union, or we can't be as strongly all for redistribution and nothing for jobs. That was a powerful moment that helped get to the point where you had a Bill Clinton eventually and people who understood job creation. And now and by the way, that's what Dewey did before 1948 when they had conferences and the governors who needed Roosevelt's New Deal to run their states tried to control the worst crazy part of the Republican Senate to save their state economies.
Sir. Please comment on the recent discussions about working class Americans not voting or voting contrary to their interests by voting Republican, which is contrary to what many liberals think. They are voting for a vision consistent with their values.
I think there's a lot of problems with the data and the evidence. This all goes back to a book, What's Wrong with Kansas? Mm-hmm. The book is fundamentally inaccurate in many ways. There is no state in the country where the poor don't vote more Democratic than the rich, and the middle class isn't somewhere in the middle. And the shifts have only to do with the South. Tom Edsel just, in fact, did a big summary of all the recent data from all the tracking over all the years. I think it was in the New York Times today, looking at all the changes. If you in the South, there have been some changes. Outside the South, the patterns hold. But the fact is, everywhere, there's economic problem.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is UC San Diego political science professor Sam Popkin, who is discussing his new book, The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. Do you see, Sam, do you see a fundamental shift in how partisan politics have become, or is this election just the business as usual? There's been a lot of talk about how aggressively partisan politics have become. What's the impact on that?
It comes and goes. I think the only thing as vicious as the last 2 years was the period 46 to 48, when you'd had, you know, Roosevelt for 16 years, and the Republicans got in, and the first thing they said was, we're going to open every session of Congress with a prayer and close it with a probe. And they really were out to get everybody. And they overdid it. They totally self-destructed. I mean, it made Newt Gingrich look like a moderate. Now, President Obama had a very interesting line. I don't know if he's going to stand tough and really use it. And the line was, in my next term, the Republican fever will break. But I keep thinking of a line, and somebody in Seattle, when I gave a talk, found the source of it. And the line is, moderation is only a virtue when you have an alternative. Turns out that's a Kissinger line. But it's still a great line. And I think of that every time I think about the president saying, well, we can work together. You know, the difference between being pliable and weak and being one of these people who speaks softly and carries a big stick or who is ready to take you on and necessary is some evidence. Al-Qaeda knows it, but I haven't seen a tough veto yet. I haven't seen a tough stand. And I'm not saying it's needed because I'm not a crystal ball. I don't know what's in the data, but I worry about whether he's actually showing people enough. He's the last hope they have to stop the Ryan budget if they don't like it. And, of course, some people love it. Mm-hmm.
We actually have several questions that are related to that. One asks, how will the assault on unions that's going on in many states around the country by Republicans affect the election?
I think it'll energize the union vote. I think it's actually, in this economy, extraordinary that even in my home state, Wisconsin, the pro-union vote got 47%. And in the exit polls in that election, President Obama looked actually very strong.
If LBJ is 100 on a scale of 1 to 100 and using the levers of the presidency, where would you put, one, Obama based on his 3.5 years, and where would you project Romney if he wins?
That's hard. I'm thinking. Now, I'm not stalling.
That's a lot
I'm thinking. I'm really thinking. I put him... I put him well ahead of Kennedy and Carter, and he certainly, I have to put him ahead of the first 2 years of Clinton. So maybe in 80 and 84. But I'm not about to give him much more until I see how he pulls off the next 6 months. You know, they all have a hard time coming. Clinton came around a little faster on the divided government, but Clinton walked in thinking he owned Washington and made a fool of himself the first 2 years. Obama got a hell of a lot done. You know, he can't help the fact that everything got racialized because he happens to be African-American, you know. But he got a lot done. So I give his first 2 years, maybe in 88. And now I'm waiting to see how he handles it this summer. He's got the student interest rates, which is a big one. That's 7 million people on the line on their interest, $1,000 a year each on these games. You can play it any way you want, but he's got a big one there. And he's got the debt ceiling. And he's got Taxmageddon when the Bush tax cuts come out and what he's going to do. And he said, there he said, maybe I should give him an 86. He said exactly the right thing. His Cleveland speech laid out the economics. He said, you can't beat a plan by complaining about it. You can't beat an immigration plan by saying, that's mean. You can't beat a budget by saying, that hurts. You got to have a second budget that said, my budget hurts less. Obama's line in Cleveland, which was really very good, was, Reagan good. He said, we have no choice but to reduce the deficit. The only choice is how we do it. You know, and he's laying out and pointing out they haven't said yet what cuts to be named later will be. And that was, as you know, as a Reagan expert who covered President Reagan, they always had the smoke and mirrors I write about where they call it the magic asterisk. They'd always say in the budget, cuts to be named later. That's why the deficit doubled. Later hasn't come yet. And Obama's pushing, so this is later. Tell us, you know, the cuts. That's really a very important thing if he sticks to it and says, show me, you know, show me the money, Tom Cruise would say, show me the goods. Where do you stand on it? What are you going to cut?
We have another sort of crystal ball question along those lines. I know academics love crystal ball questions. You love predicting the future.
Right? So I can pontificate.
Should Obama win the election, and I will add, assuming that Congress stays roughly the way it is.
Yes, I think he should.
What will become of his domestic priorities?
I think that if he wins, he's going to be very concerned about the long-term savings rate in the country, because that's something that everybody agrees you can't get out of the debt traps, you can't get out of the interest rate traps until there's more saving in the country. And in the short term, he's probably, you know, Krugman is almost certainly right that if you don't do something with all the excess capacity to use it to build the bridges, the roads, the schools, you'll never get going again. Robert Shillard gave a very, very good analogy for that. He said, you know, in the winter when there's nothing to do on the farm, that's when you spend money to repair the barns. You know, that's when labor is cheap. You fix the fences. And that's the closest I've come to explaining to people. The hardest thing, I've been trying for 30 years to come up with an analogy. Why, when we're all tightening our belts because we are all doing with less, should the government be loosening his and spending more? It's true, but it's counterintuitive that the government should spend to get us going again, and somebody has to explain it or just do it.
You talk in the book about campaigns fighting the last war, which is a very common thing. What would you say Obama and Romney have learned from past elections, and are they repeating the mistakes or avoiding them?
I was surprised. Okay, Governor Romney learned one very, very important thing, which was when you're a candidate, you can't be in the room all the time making all the decisions and micromanaging and listening to so many people. And he realized he had to have a smaller working group that he listened to, because if you're a candidate, you're acting like a royal family, walking around and showing people your values, and you're out there projecting your vision, and then there's all the management of the campaign. You have to delegate more than you used to. And he learned that this time. But what he didn't learn is he's been talking about immigration since 2007. He repudiated his own health care plan. And he wrote another famous op-ed saying, if you bail out Detroit, it'll be a disaster and it'll be the end of the American auto industry. He is not explained any of that. And to me, the really shocker is I haven't seen him explain Bain. I mean, does he think people aren't going to repeat the old Kennedy ads that Gingrich recycled? Does he think people aren't going to notice that when he was in charge of Bain, they were pioneers of outsourcing or offshoring? And now they're saying, well, you don't understand the difference between the two. Well, that he should explain the difference. I'm actually very surprised. One of the oldest things in the world is if it's going to come out, you bring it out, inoculate, vaccinate, or at least if you got a problem and you want to prove you have a difference with somebody, insult somebody, pick a fight, define your enemies. All he's done, I mean, he can't use religion quite because of the prejudice in his party. So he talks about the president being European. But he hasn't really explained a lot himself.
He's European, but at least he's not French, is he?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, the person who spent 2 years as a French missionary but who doesn't want Mormons to visit America,
I have, as a former journalist, I have a question for you that has to do with the media and what's become of it. What's the impact of all the new media, texting, tweeting, Facebook? and the decline of the mainstream media, the impact of MSNBC versus Fox.
Well, as a very esteemed former bureau chief of Newsweek, I'm sorry to say that there isn't any evidence that people are less politically engaged or less knowledgeable about the policies than in the days of the nightly news when 60% or 70% watched the Nets. And there isn't any evidence that there's more sleaze or slime. What we see is there are things that are fun to talk about that go viral. The president singing Chicago, or, you know, a song here or there, or new modes. But the big thing they do is they change the distribution of power in the party, because there's all these other people who can get messages out there and resurrect stuff. That's one of the big changes. You might have just seen in the last few days, Governor Romney, the photo of the Bain founders waving their dollar bill when they had their first big score. You know, every part of your past history is there. So you have to be prepared to deal with it. It's nothing disqualifies anybody anymore, but except acting stupid when you talk about it when it comes out. You have to know what your life has been and how you're going to talk about it. Mm-hmm. On the media thing, but it's interesting how much it's changed since 1992. You know, the model for all the campaigns is still the war room. All the challengers campaigns, the kids all watched the documentary of the war room and see how it was done. Well, in the war room, James Carville's great line was, "You haven't said anything in American politics till you say it on television." Most of the young people in America don't even own a television set. YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, BuzzFeed, SMS. I'm bad with my thumbs, so I'm really feeling inadequate some days when I have to sit down at a PC to do my tweets, which I don't do enough of. And it's a very interesting change that now you have the social media. And in 2008, there was a real milestone. The first candidate for president to put a real political ad on a virtual billboard in a media game was Senator Obama. I mean, that's a big breakthrough. And there's more and more ways of getting to people. And it actually, where it's really making the campaigns better is you've got, on every topic, you've got a high audience and a low audience. You got the 2% of the people who really understand an issue getting a lot of it. And you got everybody else getting a little of it somewhere. And the 2% or the 5% can really raise hell if you say stupid things that they don't like or they don't get. And so the candidate has to know a lot more today than in the past. You know, John Kennedy traveled the country with two people. When he formed his cabinet, he had never met McNamara or Rusk. Sort of winged it. Now, no matter what, you have to spend months and months and months learning the issues, getting to know the people. You're closer, you're not there when you get to the White House, but you're much closer to knowing what's going on mm-hmm. than you did in the past.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Obama and the teleprompter issue. Does he use a teleprompter more than anybody else? I mean, there's a lot of talk about Clinton and how he could go on forever without knowing.
Yeah, well, he did go on forever. That was one of the problems. Right. The problem with Clinton was shorten the forevers, please. Right. They can all riff it sometimes. And I don't know how much they use it. I'm not one of these people who's good enough to notice the prompted or the unprompted versions. But I think it's a very big convenience for all of them, and I don't really know if he's using it more. But you notice the eloquence isn't the same. People like to talk about charisma. He's as if it's a natural trait of the candidate. Oh, Mitt Romney's not charismatic, or Obama's not charismatic. Charisma is situational. Charisma is about hope. When they're inspiring hope, they're charismatic. You know, when the bugle calls and the cavalry came in the old Westerns, they were charismatic. W, as president before 9-1-1, was flat. He lost control of the Senate. He wandered. Then you needed a president desperately. You're worried. You know, after 9-1-1, he gets on the pile of rubble, and suddenly he's the heroic. He did not have a personality transplant. You had a situational transplant where you needed him more than you did before. I mean, I'm not indicting you. I mean, many people.
You talked about Yoda and the sort of image that people look for. With Clinton, of course, you had bimbo eruptions and all sorts of problems which he overcame. What's the biggest problem that Obama has to deal with in his personality or presentation, and the most difficult thing for Romney?
He likes to be detached. The president doesn't like to be the leader of a pack, of a team, of a side. He likes to be the person in the middle, like Socrates on one hand, on the other hand. And I laughed in the campaign when he was like this in 2008 in Iowa, because I realized he's got the professor's disease, which I understand and have never been cured of. And the professor's disease is you're in the classroom. You can blather as long as you want. If you don't know what I said, you don't get a grade. You don't earn a grade unless you listen to me no matter what. In a campaign, it's the other way around. If you don't listen to me, I fail. I realize that doing book tours, by the way. You have to be much more careful than in a classroom, or people just leave. You have to be precise, and he is getting much better at it. His Cleveland speech really drew an edge. He doesn't like to have an edge. He likes to say, we can work it out, we can get together, we can mediate. He has to have an edge now, and he was very good against Senator Clinton at indirectly making an edge by saying, we want to change the tone of Washington, making it clear she's the tone we want to change. But he never said it. Now you have to be much more, there's a we and there's a they. And he's starting to do it. And I think that's a problem for him.
Mm-hmm. What about Romney? What's his big problem?
His big problem is he has not faced a narrative that gets from Bain Capital to what you do as a president. Over and over and over again, he says, Mitt Romney, Governor Romney, before he was, you're going to hear more about the Olympics, I predict, at the Republican convention than the last 10 conventions, because he did such a brilliant, heroic public service job of saving the Winter Olympics. And so he's going to show you that he does things for America and he's patriotic. But he's never really explained, what did I learn at Bain that's good for America? The Republicans were happy to hear him say, I've been in business, Obama's been in the faculty lounge, or thinking European ideas. But in the campaign, when everybody knows about outsourcing or offshoring, whichever you call it, when everybody in the campaign knows about the closed factories, when everybody in the campaign knows about the problems, he can't just say, well, I'm going to do for America what I did for Bain. And he's already said, I like to fire people, which is not bad if you're talking about the post office or a bloated bureaucracy. But, you know, what you do that makes Office Depot eat Staples lunch or vice versa, or what you do that makes General Motors get 80% of the market and kills Hyundai or Kia, that doesn't tell you what do you do about the people that need jobs in new industries, or what does it do about all sorts of other areas. And I think that's an area where he really has a hole yet. I've been actually frankly surprised that he hasn't talked about some way of segueing. You know, General Eisenhower didn't say, because I ran the army, I can run the government. You know, I give orders the way I did to the general staff. He had to learn how to do what he considered humiliating things, answer simple questions to show people he listened, that he wasn't a martinet like General MacArthur, who wanted to be more of an imperial Caesar than a listening president. So I'm surprised that we haven't seen more of that yet. And I get a feeling that he's not good at being anything but just the Bain executive. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm waiting to see what's the surprise at the convention when Romney is reinvented. And that's a legitimate thing. The use of the phrase etch-a-sketch was an accurate description with a foot in the mouth. Earlier on when they asked his campaign manager, Eric Fernstrom, about the damage, he said, look, the candidate's like an etch-a-sketch, and we've got we can reinvent them. We can redefine them. Etch-a-sketch is wrong. Maybe more like Mr. Potato Head. And I don't mean that he's a potato head. I mean, you can put things on, but you can't take them off. You can't etch-a-sketch. Everybody knows etch-a-sketch. You can start over. You can get it back to zero. You don't do that in a campaign. You can add to the story. One of the best that way was the 92 Clinton convention. Everybody thought because he'd been a Rhodes Scholar and a draft dodger, he was a rich, privileged kid who got away with things while everybody else went off to die. When they learned about the poverty, never met the father, the snakes in the outhouse, and all those bits, it made him more, well, it's okay if you got out of the draft if you're just like us. You know, it made him Bubba and not Yaley. You know, more man of the people. And that, you know, that was adding to the story. They didn't say it's not true about Jennifer Flowers. They didn't say forget about I never inhaled. They didn't say forget that he didn't want to go to Canada because he wanted to run for office someday, all the stories. They just made those, you know, bumps in the road with a real story along the center. And that's what I'm surprised that the Romney campaign hasn't started more to do.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask one last question about Romney. One of the things that Eisenhower said that he learned when he became president was that when you're a general and you give an order, something happens. And when you're the president, you give an order, it's not necessarily true. What do we know about how Romney might be as president from how he was as governor?
He did a very good job when he wanted to do health care and do something about a budget crisis. Then he repudiated a lot of what he did and changed it in the last 2 years, including making it nearly impossible to use to do more stem cell research and open up a lot of science in the state. But his time as governor was respectable. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is not an incompetent executive, but he is not a person who sold people on where he's going to go. And he was working with the Democrats in Massachusetts, not with Republicans. And he had a very much easier time as Obama can working to the middle when there was a plan everybody wanted. That was when the Heritage Foundation thought that the health care plan was a great conservative plan.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for one last question.
But you should ask one, sir, because you've done the work.
And that is there any chance that Hillary might be selected as vice presidential running mate for Obama? And how might Biden step aside gracefully?
Nobody steps aside gracefully as vice president. You know, the new Robert Caro book suggests that Kennedy wanted to replace Johnson. I'm sure that's true because of the vitriolic hatred Bobby carried to his grave for LBJ. But in 1956, Eisenhower wanted to replace Nixon, and Herbert Brownell led a delegation to Nixon and said, for the good of the party, you should step down. And Nixon said, call on me to do it in public. If the president says it out loud in a speech, I'll think about it. You know, you have to do it. Do I admire Hillary Clinton a whole lot? Yes. Do I think she's done a fabulous job as Secretary of State? Yes. Do I think it would be good for President Obama to bring her in over Joe Biden? No. There is no way to explain why you wanted to do it. If Senator Biden had a health crisis and they called on Secretary Clinton to save the day, no complaints. But do I think it's a good idea? No. Politically, that is. Not morally. Talking about victory.
Our thanks to Sam Popkin, professor at UC San Diego and author of the new book, The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. And thank you to our audiences here and on television, radio, and on the Internet. I'm Jerry Lubinow, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is now adjourned.
That was great.